Hi, my name is Alejandra Salemi, and you're listening to the Healing Theology Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Healing Theology Podcast. Very excited for today's guest. And I just want to jump right in and get to ask him cool questions. So before we do that, let me introduce him real fast. Dr. David Eagle is an assistant research professor of global health and sociology at Duke University. In his role at Duke, David leads the Religion and Social Change Lab, which is a group of researchers who study how broader religious changes in North America impact churches, focusing specifically on careers of religious leaders. David completed his PhD in sociology at Duke in 2015 and holds a THM from Duke Divinity School and an MDiv from Fresno Pacific Seminary. David has published widely on clergy careers, religion and polarization, and the changing landscapes of religion in the United States and in Canada. A major strand of his work examines the health of clergy with a special focus on the role of social relationships and health, theological education, mental health, and obesity. And before coming to Duke, David served as a pastor in Victoria, British Columbia, in the Mennonite Church. So as you can tell, we are very excited to have David here on the podcast. Do you want to tell us how you're doing and how things are going?
Things are doing well. I find myself in a really fun stage of my career where I get to lead a big team, do research that has both academic but also practical implications. And yeah, and being able to do work that I'm interested in is a real gift. And I know that not everybody has that opportunity. So I'm thankful to be able to do this work and to be able to talk about some of what I found and some of my thoughts around health and religion and clergy.
Can you give us a super bird's eye view of the research that you have around the changing roles of churches in North America?
I think if you look sort of big picture at what's going on in churches in North America, there are, I would say, sort of four big mileposts or signposts that mark this landscape that we're in. Firstly, and lots of people have pointed this out, is the impact of secularization or the decline of the importance of religious institutions to the average North American. That's impacting many denominations and religious traditions, but particularly mainline denominations, and to a somewhat lesser extent, Roman Catholic churches and evangelical or conservative Protestant groups. But we've seen a huge decrease in the number of people who attend church and the number of people who find religion important in their lives. And this isn't evenly spread across the sort of American landscape, but it's definitely concentrated amongst younger people. And so that means this is becoming a huge number of implications for churches. Churches are smaller. They have fewer resources locally. Denominations and other collective religious institutions have fewer resources to draw from. And religious institutions don't command the same kind of cultural and social respect as they once did. So that's just having massive implications for all kinds of different areas of religion, and especially for clergy. Somewhat related to that is the other big changes that we've noticed is this massive increase in affective polarization. And that's just this tendency for people on either side of the political divide to increasingly sort of dislike members of the other side. And this has led to a just decrease in things like split ticket voting. It's decreased the number of sort of social contacts that Democrats and Republicans have in our culture, and it's really turned up the heat on the debates. And certainly, religious institutions have not been immune from this, and they're often at the center of a lot of the debates around the future of our country. And so, this is again having massive impacts on congregations. The United Methodist Church is going through a split right now, which is largely driven by some of these broader cultural trends. So we're seeing it in all kinds of different ways. And I've touched on this before. Generational divides are just really, really significant in terms of religious affiliation, in terms of social attitudes and beliefs. And there are definitely big, big debates that are going on in religion and between religious and non-religious people that also have a really strong generational component. So those are kind of the three big changes that I see sort of as I look down from 10,000 feet sort of thing.
Yeah. I just want to reflect back some of the things that you said to the podcast. So it's really interesting to hear the way that there seems to be like a growing split or polarization, right? Maybe churches are becoming less diverse in the sense of like political ideology or theology or ideology in general. It also sounds like the drop off of what maybe some research would call like the nuns and duns, right? Like people, N-O-N-E nuns instead of N-U-N nuns, people who have never been religious at all, or people who are done with religion. So we have a drop off of likely more liberal leaning people who just aren't part of the like church population anymore. And so the concentration is becoming a little bit more right leaning. And so it's really interesting. I know we have ties with Dr. Mark Chaves here at Duke University, with who you did your PhD with, and a professor that I look up to a lot. I'll link his book in the podcast notes as well, because I think he lays out a lot of these like really, you know, not to be alarmist, but some really eye-opening trends around like where religion is heading. And I think the book is maybe a little dated by now. Maybe it came out in like 2016 or so, but I think the trends from what he told us in class last semester doesn't seem to be like they're not taking a radical left turn. Like they're kind of trending in the same direction as they were a couple of years ago. Can you tell us a little bit about what the implications of some of these trends for professional training of ministers could be? So, you know, obviously there's divinity schools throughout the country. You and I have spent time in divinity schools. So can you tell us how these trends are impacting the education that our religious leaders are getting?
Yeah, this is having really, really major implications for the training of religious leaders. You are right to point out that it tends to be that somewhat less religiously active and much more politically liberal people. They're the ones who tend to be leaving churches. And if they aren't members of churches, are very unlikely to join churches. And the people sort of left behind are more likely to be more conservative and more Republican leaning. So churches have become more conservative spaces overall for the churches that are left with the decline of the mainline. You see this in the Roman Catholic Church. It's become a lot more Republican since the 1970s. That's not because there's an increasing number necessarily of Republicans. It's much more about the more liberal Democrats leaving the Roman Catholic Church over abortion, over the scandals with clergy abuse. And we're seeing that, you know, in mainline denominations as well. Evangelical church has largely been a more conservative Republican organization. We're seeing it less so there, but still definitely those trends are affecting that church. The one thing that we know that, especially in the evangelical world and in the more conservative mainline Protestant world, is that there's fewer ministers receive seminary training to be pastors. And mainline churches have always been kind of the main feeder for a lot of seminary graduates. But with the decline in the numbers of mainline churches and the size of mainline churches, there's just not nearly as many places for pastors to go. And so we've seen a lot of large mainline seminaries close, and seminaries having to increasingly rebrand themselves of not only training pastors, but also showing that the training that you receive in seminary can be used in other careers and other places as well. So, which again creates some challenges for seminaries.
Yeah, and that's an interesting kind of line of thought too, because it's interesting to look at the way that education, right? Because I think a lot of religious leaders, especially in the US context or in the North America context, have some sort of graduate school training. A lot of spaces require some type of master's to be a religious leader. And so can you tell us about how you think that the changing landscape of seminaries and divinity schools are going to impact, it's going to trickle down to the way that the churches are built? I guess it could be a potentially leading question. I've heard a little bit about, you know, as congregations become more conservative, a lot of times people who go to divinity schools or seminaries, not always, but sometimes can come out more liberal. And so what is the implications of that divide as the congregations are becoming potentially more conservative, but the people who are leading them and preaching every Sunday are actually becoming more liberal? What implication does that have for the well-being of the pastor, the congregational leader?
Yeah, so we've done some work on this phenomenon. It's especially pronounced in the United Methodist Church, and especially in states like North Carolina, where there is still a large number of rural United Methodist churches in the state. And of course, the United Methodist Church uses this system of appointments where bishops and cabinets decide where to send pastors. It's not that churches go out looking for pastors and they apply. So you do end up with more situations where pastors get placed in congregations that are different from them. And so, you know, in places like North Carolina and United Methodist tradition, folks coming to seminary are much more likely to have grown up in a city, in an urban area, and are much more likely to come from a larger church. They come to a divinity school like Duke, when we do have evidence that there is some liberalization that goes on, especially with social attitudes, not as much with theological beliefs. And then most often, the sort of median appointment that you're going to get sent to after divinity school is a rural United Methodist congregation. And we know that, you know, rural areas in North Carolina are much more conservative. These churches tend to be at least perhaps evenly split between Democrats and Republicans, or Republican kind of leaning. And so young pastors are finding themselves in both communities that are very polarized. The other trend that we have seen is that rural areas have become more uniformly conservative, urban areas more uniformly liberal. So people are living in contexts where they feel more at odds with, and then they are coming into churches where they are feeling more at odds with the people they serve. And I don't think we've done a great job in educating young people, educating people generally on how, on the sort of basic skills of how do we get along as people and how do we build community across divides. And so I think there's just a lot of struggles. And like I said, with this affect of polarization, which just, if I'm a Democrat, today I hate Republicans more than I did, 20 years ago, with that growing tension that we feel with people from the members of the out party, that just makes it much more difficult to love the people that you are pastoring, which is sort of foundational to ministry. Is you really do have to, come to love and appreciate everyone in your congregation. So that's becoming increasingly difficult. We definitely have heard from bishops in North Carolina that they are really concerned with high levels of attrition from young pastors, that they're seeing this was never really an issue in the Methodist Church of people leaving the career early in their careers, but we're starting to see a lot of that more. And I think this is a major challenge.
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking to see people, just young people. I mean, people that I've gone through my own ordination process with, who are just so burnt out before they even hit 30 and are just feeling the weight of, whether it's the way that the United Methodist Church does the appointment process, which I can link an article in the show notes that explains it more, because I think it's a little bit different than maybe other denominations to handle the process. But I think it's an anecdotal example, but I was a rural pastor, like a lay pastor, for maybe 3 or 4 months when I first moved to North Carolina in a rural county here. And I didn't last very long because they didn't believe that women could be pastors. And they also raised a lot of eyebrows because I came from Harvard Divinity School and I was like that liberal place. And I made a comment, kind of a passing comment, about affirming queer colleagues who were denied ordination. And it blew up. Like they outed me very quickly. So it's really heartbreaking. I think, I will maybe deviate a little bit from the questions that I sent you, but that makes me think of something that I wonder what your research has said around, we know the kind of burden that clergy, young clergy perhaps, or clergy who are more progressive in more conservative spaces, they take on this kind of mental health toll in their profession. And I wonder if you could say something, if your research shows anything around clergy of color or clergy of maybe different minority statuses or underrepresented identities, and how maybe those negative health outcomes compound for them.
Yeah, I can say a few things about that. A lot of my research centers on the United Methodist Church, which is a predominantly white church. So my research, direct research on minority communities, is more limited. But I can say a few things about that. Firstly, there is this really interesting finding that both Mark Davis has found in his national survey of religious leaders. What we also see in our surveys of Methodist clergy is that mainline clergy and more liberal clergy definitely evidence higher rates of symptoms consistent with, say, depression or other mental illness than more conservative folks do. And we know that more liberal folks are often in contexts where they're around more conservative people. And so there's this sort of tension between their beliefs and the beliefs of the people in their congregations. So they're managing that tension probably more than, say, conservative folks who pastor churches that are more similar to who they are. So that's definitely one thing we see, just sort of generally amongst more liberal people. Speaking of sort of minoritized clergy people, we've done some research on the United Methodist Church And we see several kind of major trends. So one is that we see large pay gaps between members of racialized minorities and predominantly white pastors. Predominantly, there's still a real strong tendency to match black pastors with black churches, white pastors with white churches, sort of seen across denominations. And just owing to structural inequalities, black churches just have fewer resources to support their clergy with. They tend to be smaller, more fragile communities. At least numerically and financially. And so pastors just don't receive the same pay and don't necessarily have the same ability to advance into the larger organizations, which pay more and have more, you know, more support for pastors to do their work. So that's definitely one thing we see as a huge gap in pay. In our own research with minoritized clergy in majority white denominations, there's a lot of difficulties that minoritized people experience through the ordination process. They experience the ordination process much differently, a much more difficult process for them to go through. And they run into a lot more barriers than white pastors who are going through ordination. And then we also hear many stories of especially black clergy in North Carolina who face very overt racist threats and incidences. And if they come to serve a majority white congregation in certain communities, there will be a really strong pushback. But that's definitely going on. The other big thing that's going on, especially in black churches, is that the civil rights movement, which once used to be centered in churches, that's really changing as well. While you know, churches are still an important part of that, Black Lives Matter movement is unique in that it's not attached to religion in the same way that the previous civil rights organizations were as well. So people who have an interest in political organizing are not necessarily, black people who are interested in political organizing are not necessarily gravitating towards the clergy as a occupation risk to do that. So there's definitely some questions as to, you know, what the future role of the church is in the civil rights movement and for black people in seminaries who really feel the call to confront systemic inequalities. There's lots more questions about what's the best way to do that and whether or not churches really are the ideal way to advance civil rights. So I think those are some really important conversations that are happening. Again, not to underplay the importance, the continued importance of black churches, but definitely a really, really big change up there. I guess one last thing I'll say is, you know, mostly what we find in our research health-wise is that you don't see huge differences between black, Hispanic, and white clergy in health outcomes that are in any way sort of different from what we see at the population at large. All the sort of inequalities, health inequalities that are built into the U.S. system, you see manifest themselves in very similar ways in minoritized populations.
There's so many questions that come to mind right now. I'm going to maybe jump backwards to move forward. A little bit ago, we were talking about the kind of liberalization that happens for students who go through divinity school trainings. And I'm wondering, you know, it's interesting because I guess I'd never made the connection of how Black Lives Matter, the movement is so much different than other kind of civil rights movements that have always been so tied to the church, but specifically to the Black church or kind of being spearheaded by people of color. So I'm wondering, you know, there seems to be this kind of double whammy loss for divinity schools or like theological trainings where people are starting to question whether they're just spaces for like brainwashing and liberalization and, you know, this kind of resistance to engage in those spaces by conservative groups. And at the same time, people who are seeking out community via like more liberal movements might not find that community either at divinity school because there are spaces for that now happening in secular spaces. And so can you tell us about if you've done surveys or qualitative research of any sort around how divinity schools are not brainwashing spaces? Like that is not actually what's happening. And at the same time, kind of the lacking role of what I would call like the religious left. And we need more like people like Reverend Barber, right, with the Poor People's Campaign, people who are really leading these like social change movements from a religious standpoint. Cornel West, right? We don't have a lot of those in the same way that we did in the 60s. So can you address this kind of double whammy loss that might be happening?
Yeah, so definitely in our research, we see very strong evidence that it's not brainwashing that's going on in seminaries. That's not the mechanism through which liberalization is happening in students. And we know this because we see that we see differences in how people's beliefs change over seminary, over their time. Definitely at a place like Duke Divinity School, you are more likely these days, especially, to find more progressive professors, and you will likely encounter progressive ideas in your classes. But the extent to which you adopt those as your own really depends on the friends that you have and or don't have at seminary. So people who come to Duke Divinity School, for instance, this is where we have most of the data. I think this applies in many contexts, and build friendships. They tend to be the students that we see become more liberal. And my sense is that they are coming in, that happens because many of these students who are coming in with questions and have had some niggling doubts about some of the beliefs that they were raised with or that the churches that they come from have taught. And so they're seeking out other people at the Divinity School who are also in this kind of same space. You know, people attract people who are like them on all kinds of different dimensions. And so as people who might have some questions are getting together, they're talking, that's where I think these ideas and this permission to be a more liberal person emerges. And what's really interesting, we don't see things like belief in God or belief in things like God is active in my life. These don't change in students, pretty much any student at the Divinity School. So it's not that people are becoming less Christian or less religious, but they're finding ways to be liberal and religious at the same time, which they may not have had that language or permission for. Among students who don't develop friendships at the Divinity School, you just don't see much change. You definitely don't see this liberalization. So it's not really indoctrination so much as it is putting students together who might be going through similar struggles and then wrestling those together and then finding permission. We see this with lots of students who come out during seminary. You know, they just maybe grew up in context where being a gay Christian was just not a thing, or didn't have any other folks that they went to church with who are also gay. And so they come to seminary, they meet gay Christians that are like, oh, wait, I can be a gay Christian. Whereas before that was sort of a stigmatized thing, or seen as not something possible. So we definitely see that phenomenon. And my sense is this is sort of the process through which like liberalization happens. It's a social process, a social group process. It's not indoctrination, I think, as many on the right would accuse.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a product of like the Socratic nature of Divinity School, where you're expected to ask why for 15 to 18 pages for every class that you take. And you really get into the weeds of kind of deconstructing and then reconstructing with maybe better language or, you know, better resources to reconstruct with. And yeah, I think it's helpful to hear so much of the pushback of it's not the institution, or, you know, maybe we could call it the pedagogy or the syllabi that are created that's creating a liberalization, but more of just the opportunity, the curiosity, the playground to ask questions. And that can lead to being exposed to other people with different perspectives, people from different parts of the country or the world, and how it's almost like ignorance comes to die in a really like necessary and beautiful way to just expand our minds into something that maybe we haven't thought of before. So anyways, I can rant about how beautiful I think my personal Div School experience was, but that is the point. I would love to hear more, though, about the research that you lead with the Seminary to Early Ministry Study. Can you tell us a little bit about what it is and some of the findings that you found through that?
Sure. So most of the work that I do is funded by a private foundation called the Duke Endowment, separate from Duke University, but also established by James B. Duke 100 years ago. And part of that foundation's role is to support rural United Methodist churches in North Carolina. And they spend a lot of money each year to that end. And so a lot of our clergy health work has been funded by them. And in speaking with project officers who spend a lot of time in churches, I think they were definitely picking up this feeling that the gap between what happens in seminary and what is needed to be a pastor and what communities need in their pastors seems to be either growing, or there seems to be a disconnect. Probably that disconnect has been there for a long time, but it feels particularly acute now, especially in the mainland Protestant context where churches are getting smaller. It's just not necessarily feasible to send a person off for 3 years of residential divinity school and then have them come back. There aren't the resources for that kind of education. And so that and a whole bunch of other kinds of related themes kept coming up. And so we decided to say, well, let's take a deep dive into what student experiences look like during their time in divinity school. let's figure out who's coming to Divinity School. Is there something as part of this sort of disconnect between pastors and their congregations? Is that just because the people coming to seminary are strange? Are some of the health concerns that we see in pastors because more unhealthy people are coming to Divinity School? We wanted to ask that question. And then we wanted to ask about, you know, what happens during Divinity School? Something happening during Divinity School or not happening during Divinity School that's leading to pastors who maybe aren't equipped adequately to lead or who run into a lot of challenges with their maintaining their own personal health in congregations. The other wonderful thing about the Duke Endowment is they're committed to staying in North Carolina for the long term, and they're committed to funding research projects that last a long time so we can really dig in deeply. And so they funded a study to follow 4 classes of Duke Divinity students from when they enter through about 5 years post-graduation. So we'll have 8-ish years of data on about 550 students as they go through the program as they head into ministry. And we're able to look at, you know, are divinity students different than other people their age? You know, what predicts flourishing and thriving in ministry? How do students' beliefs change? How do career intentions change? What are those early experiences in congregational ministry? So it's a really, really unique opportunity to follow a group of people for a very long time. It has never been done before with seminary students. Longitudinal studies of this sort of scope are still really rare in social science. So it's a wonderful opportunity to at least get a snapshot of what's going on, at least in one divinity school, in one context.
Yeah, that we're excited to see what kind of emerges from the data as the years go on. And especially, I think the potentially good thing or the quirky thing is that you're looking at a denomination that is going through a very changing, turbulent time. And I think with General Conference coming up in, oh my gosh, like a couple of weeks at this point now, more than months, it'll be really interesting to see what the data shows as you're looking back on that and see what remains. We have one more question, but you and I had a conversation earlier this week that kind of left me pondering a lot, especially on the context of the United Methodist Church and the kind of potential / maybe inevitable split that's happening. But we were talking a little bit about kind of the mental health differences and the physical health differences of clergy that are maybe more liberal and more conservative. And so from what I remember, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like liberal clergy sometimes have more of a mental health burden, maybe because they're caring so much about the hurting in the world and are a little bit more in tune with the pulse of what's happening in the world. Versus some of the data was showing you that some of the more conservative clergy maybe don't have the same mental health burdens, but sometimes they have like higher rates of obesity or have some like more physical, like negative physical health outcomes. And so can you explain to us like what the data is saying and why that could be happening? Like what does your team think?
Sure. So we're just in the final stages of completing a report on the disaffiliation process in North Carolina. And we have, through our data, we have the ability to examine people's both physical and mental health, clergy, mental and physical health. And we're able to sort of look at those people who chose to remain United Methodist and those people who chose to leave. And so we do have this ability to look at sort of differences across the conservative liberal divide. And this divide is partly theological, but it's probably even more so political. But it's Republican leaning. Pastors who are the ones leaving the United Methodist Church. And what we see with them, we definitely see somewhat worse physical health outcomes. Rates of diabetes are higher. Rates of obesity, I think, are around 4 points higher amongst the folks who chose to leave rather than stay. So we definitely see the physical health of more conservative clergy being worse. And that probably is owing to the fact that more conservative clergy tend to live in more rural parts of the United States, of the state, and also probably owing to some class differences on diets and those and exercise, those kinds of things are probably what are driving those differences. And then on mental health, the picture is kind of reversed. We see that the pastors who are remaining in the United Methodist Church have much higher rates of sort of symptoms that are consistent with depression, anxiety, and burnout. And more conservative pastors have a lower prevalence of those concerning mental and emotional health sort of indicators. There's a longstanding finding in political science that conservative people answer, you know, well-being scales differently than liberal people. If you ask a liberal person to complete a depression screener, they will always score higher than a conservative person, or on average, they will always score higher than a conservative person. And some of this does seem to be rooted in, you know, personality differences, deeper sort of worldview kinds of differences. Some evolutionary anthropologists who try to make the case that this is also seen in primates as well. So there does seem to be something more fundamental at play there. So some of this is just how we view the world is definitely going on there. And there's also I think this goes back to our earlier conversation about the differences between clergy and their congregations within the United Methodist context and disaffiliation. It's much more uniformly conservative churches that are leaving and with conservative pastors. And so a pastor who is leaving is much more likely to be theologically and politically aligned with the majority of the people in their church, whereas the folks who are remaining are much often more liberal than the majority of people in the congregations that they serve. So there is this larger gap between them and their congregation, which, you know, I think one thing that's probably this creates is more opportunities for conflict to arise. And conflict, of course, is, you know, not great for our mental health. It's unavoidable to have conflict, but it doesn't do great things for our mental health. So that's probably partly why we see these differences as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting and alarming, but also curious. I remember when you mentioned the animal, like kind of anthropological component of this might not just be a human trend, but it could be something that like in the animal kingdom overall, like this could be happening elsewhere. I have one final question for you before our Furious Five. Personally, as I continue my research in this intersection, I have believed for a long time that clergy are some of the most influential leaders in our local communities. But, you know, it seems like the research is pointing to clergy being particularly unhealthy sometimes. You know, you kind of answered this already, but, you know, could you, I don't know if we could sum it down to just like a simple yes or no, but is being a pastor bad for your health? Like, is being a pastor some type of occupational hazard, or is this a showcase of religion being a risk factor potentially?
So there's been, you know, like earlier, say in the 1960s and 70s, even into the early 1980s, the evidence was that clergy people were healthier than the average American. It's somewhat higher rates of cardiovascular disease, probably just because there's more male clergy, but on many other measures, they were healthier. And then this seems to have changed sometime between the 1980s and the 2000s. And there's been a lot of research to try to dig into this. Some of the research is really alarmist. You will hear some people say that, you know, religion is, or being a pastor is, you know, going to shorten your lifespan by 20 years, or it's going to kill you, or you're certainly going to burn out if you're a pastor. A lot of the really alarmist research has been done poorly, and often poorly designed studies that have reached those conclusions. And the best work, including some of the work that we've done at the Clergy Health Initiative, is much more nuanced. So on the positive side, pastors have some of the highest job satisfaction of any professional in the U.S. Most pastors enjoy what they do, find their work deeply rewarding. So positively, you see, in terms of physical health, if you use, say, obesity as an indicator, there are some groups of clergy where you see concerning physical health problems. The evangelical clergy, United Methodist clergy have significantly elevated rates of obesity compared to the U.S. population. Roman Catholics, mainline Protestant clergy, they don't look that different from the general population. So, you know, there's still a lot of research that needs to be done to figure out, well, is it because people are clergy, or is it because of things like geography, social class, et cetera, education that's driving these differences? So we still have lots of questions as to whether or not being a pastor is bad for your physical health. Mental health, the picture is also similarly a little bit complex in that it really is just mainline Protestant clergy where we see this elevated symptoms consistent with things like depression. And so, you know, what is this? Is this being a clergy person that's doing this? Or is this, like I said, something more about leading an organization that's ideologically different than you are? So I tend to say that no, probably being a clergy person isn't necessarily going to make you unhealthy in any way that's different from the way that many of our jobs make us unhealthy. Our jobs are highly sedentary, involve lots of driving, you know, we're around lots of high calorie foods, especially true amongst clergy. So all those kinds of things, I think, are probably the factors that are driving poor health and not necessarily something specifically related to being a clergy person. Although, of course, caring for people and people in caregiving professions who are dealing with suffering and who feel the strain of caring for people in crisis, you know, we see definitely health workers generally have struggles with their health. So I don't single clergy out as being this group that's particularly concerning. So if you're considering being a pastor, yeah, don't worry, it's not going to kill you any more so than other professions are trying to kill you.
And on that cheery note, which I do think is a cheery note versus some alarmist research that might be out there around clergy health, I want to end our time with a Furious Five questions that I like to ask all my guests. The first is, I think, maybe self-serving, but the biggest motivator for creating Healing Theology was to kind of justify the intersection of religion and health, a space that I think oftentimes I have been told like doesn't really exist and isn't that important, or, you know, not a lot of people find themselves at that intersection. So, I mean, your bio showcases exactly how religion and health might intersect, but can you give us a self-identified, definition or how you find yourself at this intersection of health or public health and religion?
So I find myself, ironically, at this intersection somewhat accidentally. You know, I did a PhD in a program that had a really strong medical sociology program, but I, you know, that was not my focus. And I didn't intend to work at this intersection of religion and health. For me, it was, I couldn't find a academic job after I graduated and was left, you know, searching for a postdoc at the end of a failed academic search. And it just so happened that the Duke Clergy Health Initiative had money for a postdoc at the time, and I was brought on board. And it's really there that I got immersed in the health side of things. And I joined the Global Health Institute at Duke and began to gain exposure to health research. And so it really was that postdoc and the lack of opportunities in sort of more training pastors in a seminary kind of role, which I was sort of hoping for post PhD, that wound me up where I am. I'm not sure that it gives people, it's not a path that people can follow, I think, or replicate, but it's one that I sort of stumbled into, and it's been a rewarding thing. Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, let it be known to the masses that you can end up at this intersection willingly, like I did, or accidentally, like you did, and here we are doing the very similar work. So be it. If you're talking to someone who wanted to work in a similar way, I know you just said it was kind of accidental, but what advice would you give them? How would you maybe encourage people who are young researchers wanting to explore more about religion and health?
Yeah, as I said earlier, you know, one of the big trends in religion just generally is secularization of religion becoming less important to the average American and less important in the sort of institutional sense, especially in universities, which, you know, people who come to university are less likely to be religious. So it's tricky. And my recommendation always is that if you can come at the study of religion and health from the health side of things, that's probably better. You could come in really focused on health and on either training in a health profession or doing health research, and then asking questions about religion's intersection with health. But that's usually a more viable strategy than the other way around. There isn't a ton of resources available to study religion and health. So having the ability to do other things alongside studying religion and health is a really good idea. I think there is also an increasing awareness of the importance of religion and health. I was speaking with a PhD student in psychology and clinical psychology at Duke, a few weeks ago at an event. We had just listened to a Christian psychologist give a lecture, and he remarked to me is that he had never, ever once been exposed to this, to the importance of religion, or never in his coursework had encountered, you know, the importance of religion in people's lives and how to work with religion as a part of the therapeutic relationship. And so, yeah, I think there are still lots of opportunities for these sorts of things to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. On a lighter note, how are you finding joy these days? What is bringing you joy in a sometimes saddening world?
That's a great question. And yeah, I think the weight of our current situation, definitely feel that. I have a sophomore, my oldest son's sophomore in college, and I have a daughter in high school and a son in middle school. And yeah, they're coming of age in a very complicated time, and finding joy can be difficult. Where I'm finding joy these days is definitely in this space where I'm able to translate my research into sort of practical resources for pastors, for seminaries, for educators. That's really a wonderful time, a wonderful place and space to be. Academia can be kind of soul crushing for just, the median article in sociology gets read by nobody. So the work can feel like you're sort of yelling into the void, but interacting with pastors, hearing what they're going through, making connections with the work that I'm doing, that stuff like brings me a lot of joy these days.
That's awesome. On the topic of religion and health, do you have any recommendations for our listeners, be it a book or a podcast, a show, obviously promoting healing theology to people, but other than us?
Yeah, so I, in the spirit of the Ezra Klein show, I brought three book recommendations. A colleague of mine, Emily Smith, who is an epidemiologist, works in the Department of Surgery at Duke University, has recently written a book called The Science of the Good Samaritan, Thinking Bigger About Loving Our Neighbors. I think this is just such an interesting trend that gives Zondervan, which is the evangelical publishing house, publishing this book by a really serious epidemiologist about, you know, what is our responsibility to especially the poor around the world. It's a wonderful book and a wonderful example of a Christian scientist translating their work into an accessible resource that folks in the pew can dig into. It's a really wonderful book. I just recently heard Thema Bryant talk at Duke. She is a former president of the American Psychological Association, and she's written this wonderful book called Homecoming. It's a book on healing from trauma. It's a really deeply personal book, again, written by a Christian psychology professor. Thema Bryant teaches at Pepperdine University. This book covers a lot of ground around the theme of sort of reconnecting with your true self. It's not a deep dive into healing from trauma. There's lots of great books that do that. It's also not an academic book, but I've really found some wonderful nuggets in that book and helped me to embrace some positive changes. And then finally, I'm sure everybody here who listens to the podcast knows Kate Fuller's book, Everything Happens for a Reason, and Other Lives I've Loved is, I think, another just wonderful example, in this case of a historian, a theologian, writing a book on a health topic and writing at the intersection of health and theology. And that book hit the New York Times bestseller list and really shows that there is this hunger for, you know, intelligent conversations that don't, you know, stray to just providing simplistic answers about how religion relates to our well-being, but really digs deeply into suffering. It means to suffer. It means to be mortal. All that stuff. It's just a wonderful book. Another great example of translating our work as academics into more accessible resources that reach a large number of people and influence a lot of people for good.
Awesome. We'll link all of them in the show notes as well if you want to support a local independent bookstore and buy them through that. Last question that I have is, where can people connect with you?
Well, I'm through my website, which is davideagle.org, is a place where I showcase some of my work. I'm always available by email. I'm not a great social media user, so don't try to message me on Threads or X or something. It'll probably be months before I respond to you. So.
Nice. Well, you can check out Dr. Eagle's website, which will also be in the show notes. Thank you so much for spending some time and sharing your research with us and kind of walking us through some really interesting trends with clergy health and the UMC and just sharing your work with us. We really appreciate it. Do you have any closing thoughts?
No, just really thank you for this opportunity and really appreciate the work that you're trying to do and spurring these conversations forward.
Yeah, appreciate you. Thanks for joining. Thanks for tuning in to the Healing Theology Podcast. Special thanks to our video and audio editor, Emily Nagamoto. Thank you for our illustrations from Katie L., who you can find on Fiverr, and original music by Mosato Music, who will be linked as well. If you want to find out more about our podcast, you can follow us on all social media platforms, and you can find the link tree in our bio for where to find us. You can also follow us along on healingtheology.com.
Thanks for tuning in.